that care about those things. I think that that feels really important to me, is creating spaces where we can feel comfortable to express ourselves and be our as fully ourselves as possible. And there's some artists that I really look up to. They're Jesus Barraza and Melanie Cervantes. They're in the Bay Area, and they are printmakers, but they also pair up with community organizations and create graphics for them, and, you know, like plan graphics for protests. And so figuring out ways to just integrate your work in whatever way that you care about, you'll figure it out. Don't let fear stop you. One last thing I would say is you don't need a bunch of fancy stuff to be an artist. You can use your garbage, you can use a pen, you can use a burnt piece of charcoal, you can use dirt, you can use coffee. Like, you don't need stuff in order to be an artist. You can figure it out. People have been doing that since the days of the cave paintings.
Yes.
Well, I think that concludes our talk today. Thank you, Sarah, for coming on today, and thank you for everyone for participating.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. And today on Sprouts, we have a very special guest for you. I am talking to Michael Daniel. Now, if you don't know who that was President Obama's former cybersecurity advisor, and he sat on the National Security Council, and he now runs the Cyber Threat Alliance, one of the world's premier threat intelligence gathering bodies. You do not want to miss this interview. It's going to be awesome. And with that, let's start with some news. And in anonymity news, and I found this absolutely fascinating, but Google has been ordered to reveal the identity of an anonymous online reviewer only known as CBSM23 to allow a Melbourne, Australia dentist to bring a defamation lawsuit against this person. Now, this is a landmark ruling coming out of the federal court in Australia, and they declared that Google must hand over information that would help this dental surgeon track down this reviewer. Now, basically, Justice Bernard Murphy said, and I quote, he deemed it, and I quote, inappropriate to accede to the application and to grant leave to Dr. Kababe, I'm assuming that's the doctor there, to serve the proceeding on Google in the United States of America. I consider that Google is likely to have or have had control of a document or thing that would help ascertain that description of the prospective respondent, CBSM23. Now, under this order, Google will be required to provide subscriber information associated with that account, including names, phone numbers, IP addresses, location, metadata, etc., if they have it. Now, this may be from the Australian justice system, but other justice systems tend to look at other justice systems to see what the precedent is, to what the law is being made, and to how that can possibly be applied into another jurisdiction. So the United States looks at this and says, oh, okay, so Australia is now allowing basically an anonymous reviewer to be de-anonymized, and so, you know, Google has to comply with that if they want to do business in Australia. The United States may pick up wind of that. And so my question is this really a bad thing, though? I mean, think about this. We've got two things over the years that have struck me as regarding basically anonymity that are negative. When people are anonymous, we see civility go out the window. I mean, we all know that. We've seen awful things posted and all of that. And review sites like Yelp have had serious issues with reviewers wanting free stuff, or else they're going to get negative reviews. In other words, people walk in and say, you know, you're going to give me this free whatever, or I'm going to give you a horrible review on Yelp. And a lot of restaurant owners have complained about that. People suck in that sense. They really do. But there's also an upside. Anonymity gives dissidents protesting their government, some safe haven from being looked at. And anonymity does encourage people to speak up or whistleblow if needed. And so we have to balance these things, but I'd be very curious to see where this goes, and I will keep you up to date. And so that is your anonymous online account news of the week. And in 5G news, and we do have to talk about 5G once again, because conspiracy theories are still spreading like wildfire. And the question I'm asking in this news bit is, are we too late to fix this? Now, here's what's going on. And just as a quick recap, I've actually done videos on this. I don't know if you guys, anybody listening, watches my daily videos or listens to my daily podcast. I've also talked about this on the air here. And we have a problem with 5G conspiracy theories that started back, and they've been going on for a while, but they really exploded around January or so, thanks to Facebook groups that were being rather prolific with this. But this was mostly in Europe. The United Kingdom, the UK, saw a rash of burnings of cell phone, 5G specifically, cell phone towers, as did Western Europe. But now they're coming here to the United States. And according to a recent Department of Homeland Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, memo, here we go. In Tennessee, attackers have physically disabled electrical breakers at more than a dozen cell towers. In a separate incident this past April, according to this memo, white supremacists using the encrypted messaging platform Telegram basically used Telegram to encourage its people to outfit drones with explosives and fly them towards 5G tower sites. Now, the CISA released the advisory on the eve of a global protest, quote unquote, that was basically created by anti-5G activists. That was for a few weeks ago or so. Now, the conspiracy theories, fueled in part by people like Woody Harrelson, the celebrity of Cheers and a whole bunch of movie fame, basically risk hindering the deployment of 5G equipment across the United States, which is something that we really need. And this is something that the FCC's general counsel has warned about, in editorials and all of that, the last one being in the Washington Post. Now, by virtue of this, social media platforms, at least some of them anyway, are really starting to fight back against this. Twitter is getting very aggressive in labeling anything that links 5G to the coronavirus or cancer or, any one of those things to basically pop open a label. So if I see your tweet and it says, 5G causes, coronavirus, I'm going to get a label from Twitter that basically says, learn the facts about 5G, and we'll take you to an information page. Now, Facebook really isn't doing anything about this, but they are now starting to take a couple of steps in this by alerting users to basically government-owned media from outfits like Russia, Iran, China, and more. So if you're reading, let's say, state propaganda from Iran, here in the United States, and you don't realize that it's from Iran, Facebook is going to start labeling that. And so hopefully they will actually start stepping up on these just demonstrably proven false issues here. But the question is then, is it too little too late? We have a society that basically has, I think, two schools of thought, wedges and camps. Some of it is not necessarily on political lines. I've seen people both, that adhere to the left and right spectrum, of politics that have agreed that 5G actually does this because they believe the conspiracy theory more than they believe, one thing or the other. Then, of course, there is the Bill Gates brain chip, that he is creating a vaccination to, insert brain chips into all of us. And 5G is part of that control structure. So we shouldn't be spinning this up, even though it's better bandwidth and all of that. So there's a lot of things that go into this. But as we divide up into these camps, as we have our multiple schools of thought, if you will, is it too little too late? Will we ever be able to get on the same page again? And I think that's something that we really need to discuss. And it's something that we really, I think, need to understand overall, in the psyche, in the conscience, of basically the American citizenry. God, I can't speak today. So by virtue of that, we can also see other countries that have really combated false information with an education program to train their citizens on how to spot fake news, how to critically think, how to look at multiple sources and basically confirm the veracity of what you're reading. Finland, Taiwan, Germany, some other places that have been directly targeted by foreign state propaganda, like Finland had a huge Russia propaganda problem in the same way we did in the past election. Taiwan has a massive mainland China problem as well, as they have been targeting misinformation at Taiwan. one for years now, and it has been through these educational efforts of basically training the population on how to just critically think and be skeptical, until confirmation, of things like this. I think that is a very important thing. And so hopefully we'll get this straightened out, but that is your, I guess, 5G conspiracy theory news update of the week. And in quick FCC news, I thought this was actually really interesting, and I don't have much on it at this point as this story develops, but we should know that the FCC may actually be in trouble for faking support for anti-net neutrality. Now, you've heard me talk about net neutrality on the air here, and if you watch my daily videos and podcasts and all of that, I have definitely talked about net neutrality. But apparently, a federal judge has just ordered the FCC, as of a few weeks ago, to turn over server records to the New York Times, because their reporters have been looking for this, that might actually reveal that the IP addresses behind a lot of the comments that supported repealing net neutrality may actually be faked or might be part of a group, in other words, a pro-net neutrality, let's say political action group, or even from the FCC themselves. And so we are looking to get that information, because the support that the FCC says that they had from the public may not actually be real, and they may not actually have that. And so as this story develops, I will give you more information on it, but this is something that might be huge, and we'll see where this goes. And so that is your FCC/net neutrality news of the week.
And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
Hey, everybody. Nick Espinoza from the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition here. And I have an incredibly, incredibly special guest. I'm actually very excited for this guest. With me is Michael Daniel. Now, if you don't know who he is the president and CEO of the Cyber Threat Alliance, one of the premier Intel threat sharing organizations in the world. And Michael, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, quite happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Believe me, my pleasure. Now, before we dive into the Cyber Threat Alliance, or CTA, I think our audience would absolutely love to hear your background, because quite frankly, I think it's beyond impressive.
Well, thanks. I actually spent 21 and a half years in the U.S. federal government. The last 4.5, I was on the National Security Council as President Obama's cybersecurity advisor. My official title was Special Assistant to the President and Cybersecurity Coordinator for the U.S.
Wow. That is an impressive title. And I have to imagine, though, that like one of the toughest jobs in the world has to be defending the White House, which is probably the largest target for state-sponsored hacking.
So, I mean, that job had a whole lot of complexities to it. But yes, I mean, working with the security folks for the White House certainly was always, we were always under attack, under, threat of intrusion. And certainly one of the things that, we began to see over time, too, was that, generally, especially when I first started, when you would find an intruder, and they would usually just kind of slink away, right? Hmm. They would realize that you'd caught them, and they would just kind of, vanish like mist. But eventually, later on, they began to actually battle us for control over, and access to the network. And you'd knock them out, and they'd come right back. So definitely, over time, our adversaries got more and more aggressive.
Wow. So pretty much it's like an advanced persistent threat, but you know that the advanced persistent threat is there.
Yes.
Wow, that's crazy. Now, I know that like a lot of my audience that follows me, watches me, listens to me, knows that I'm very agnostic when it comes to politics. I feel like cybersecurity is neither right or left. The whole world needs this. But I know that, we have a new administration that took over from the Obama administration. And so they have done a lot of reshuffling and reassignment of cybersecurity personnel in the White House. And I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on that, just understanding what the landscape was, obviously, in the Obama administration, and now here we are.
Yeah, so I think actually overall with the Trump administration, it's been kind of a mixed bag. Within the White House, you know, they eliminated my old position. And I truly believe that was a mistake, because the nature of cybersecurity is that it's inherently a cross-disciplinary it's a cross-disciplinary issue, if you will. I mean, you need to be bringing different departments and agencies together, whether you're talking about the Defense Department and the intelligence community, law enforcement, network defenders, and you really need a strong presence at the White House to do that. And sort of downgrading that position and putting it into the background, and putting the rest of the cyber staff into the background, I don't think is very helpful. Now, to their credit, they have had some really strong people out at the departments and agencies. So people like, you know, Chris Krebs, and before she left, Jeanette Manfra at DHS, and General Nakasone up at NSA. And so, you know, that's why I say it's a mixed bag, because, you know, some parts have done well, but I think overall, we've actually receded some in the capability of the U.S. government in cybersecurity, and that's very troubling in this time.
Yeah. So to say it another way, if we are receding, we are introducing risk.
Correct.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a lateral move as a reshuffle. You believe there's possibly more risk now, even as we are evolving new cyber attack and everything else. I think that's obviously a little concerning as an American citizen, but you know, hopefully they'll get back on track. And like you said, you know, there are a lot of really good people, you know, in various departments in cybersecurity. And well, Chris Krebs, for example, I've been following his work for some time as well. So I think that's really cool. Now let's get to the Cyber Threat Alliance, because I could probably speak to you all day, you know, about the other thing. But I really want to focus on this, because you guys do just amazing work, you know, as you are sharing threat intelligence among your members. And obviously everybody across the board in cybersecurity, whether it's one-off companies or organizations and alliances like ours and yours and all of that, are seeing a rise in COVID-19, you know, related cyber threats. What is the Cyber Threat Alliance seeing, and what are you guys doing to combat this?
Well, I think what you could say is, we're not seeing an increase in the overall volume of malicious activity. So it's not like there's more phishing or more scams out there, you know, now than, say, you know, 6 months ago. But what we are seeing is a dramatic shift in the themes, and, you know, the malicious actors, the bad guys, really taking advantage of people's fears about COVID-19, about the coronavirus. And so there's been this, you know, veritable tsunami of, you know, phishing related emails that have that as a theme. You see, you know, an enormous number of websites and domains being stood up with that as a theme, as lures. And so what we've really seen is this very rapid shift into using COVID-19 and the coronavirus and the pandemic and all of those kinds of topics now as lures and as part of that malicious activity.
Yeah, and you know, and I think that's interesting too, because I think it really underscores the point that I think we see typically in cybersecurity, just going back years, at a very small level. You know, when Christmas rolls around, we see fake Christmas cards, you know, when Thanksgiving rolls around. But now we have an entire planet that is focused on one thing, and it's just, you know, exploding and all of that. And our own advisories have, you know, reported that we're not seeing really any unique phishing tactics. It seems like it's the same old. They're just now using, as you said, the, you know, COVID-19 or the coronavirus. But I find it interesting though, because your members are actually often the ones on the front lines, you know, with the threat detection systems, whether they're firewalls or endpoints or whatever that is. Your members are obviously focused on collecting threat intelligence, whatever it is, and obviously sharing it amongst your alliance. Are they seeing shifts in attack patterns or threats out there that, you know, just the rest of the world, as, you know, cybersecurity or just humans, aren't seeing?
You know, actually, I mean, I think we're, you know, when you look at it, you can see some interesting patterns. You know, obviously, ransomware has become, you know, has emerged as like the technique of choice, right, for a lot of the criminal organizations, and they use it in a variety of ways. I think that has become one of the dominant threats that you really face. companies, particularly if you're a, you know, any sort of small to medium business or a, you know, government agency or particularly municipalities, you know, municipal governments here in the United States are particularly prone to being targeted by ransomware. You know, interestingly, we saw sort of a rise and fall of cryptocurrency mining, illegitimate, you know, illicit cryptocurrency mining. And when Bitcoin went really high, you had, you know, the cryptocurrency miners really went to work. And as that fell, that sort of fell off. So you can sort of, you know, track some of those patterns. But what's, you know, I think the other thing that, you know, you mentioned is that many of these things go back years, right? And I mean, it's really a, you know, it's really just comes down to the cyber criminals are, they're just not going to change tactics if what they're doing still works. You know, for the most part, they're just going to keep doing what they're doing, and they're going to keep using the tools that they're using as long as those tools keep working. And I think it really just shows that, you know, that that the changes can be very rapid, but most of the time they're more evolutionary than revolutionary.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And I think if I were to add to that, I would probably say then we can't really discount the psychology of humans in general. You know, in a pandemic, as you mentioned before, when we're all panicking and oh my god, and so they are playing on that, using just the traditional tactics, but now it's come down, download my World Health Organization, you know, list and all of that. And, you know, that's, I find that absolutely just insane, you know, just in the explosion that, that everybody is recording. Now, I know many Cyber Threat Alliance members are obviously products that a lot of organizations and companies use, you know, and I'm not going to go through the whole list, but, you know, when I'm seeing like Cisco and Palo Alto Networks and Sophos and SonicWall and Rapid7 and a whole bunch of other, you know, threat detection members that are all part of your organization and sharing in real time, which I think is amazing, they obviously are the ones that are defending the hospitals, you know, around the world. Many of these products that you guys represent are now here. So by virtue of that, as your members are working with the hospital systems and organizations in health around the world, as well as their supply chain, because I think that's a huge thing too that a lot of people really don't talk about. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well. Are your members getting advanced insight into this pandemic from the hospital systems that they're supplying their technology and services to?
Well, I think that what you can really see from our members is that, you know, I think while we've always talked about healthcare being a critical infrastructure, right? It's always been one of the critical infrastructure sectors. I think really what you can see is just how critical that sector is, but how, but also how far they need to come, right? They have not had to face the same level of criminal activity. Sorry about the dog in the background.
We're all working from home, right? Yeah. We're all on lockdown. It's okay, no worries.
You know, I think what you can see is that the financial sector, right, has faced criminal activity that forced them to, you know, change and adapt. The energy sector was not far behind because it faced that. And while there have certainly been things, you know, that have affected the healthcare sector, like the Anthem breach and other things going back, you know, several years, I think now we're really realizing that the healthcare sector needs to make similar investments in upgrading their technology. But they face some really unusual challenges. You know, for example, many of the hospitals are public hospitals, right? So they're dependent on, you know, local governments for support. You've got, staff that are under a lot of pressure. And so, you know, how much can you upgrade security right now in the middle of a pandemic, right? I mean, and so I think this is really exposing how much we need to invest in our health sector for its security over the longer term, and not just the big hospitals, right? To your point about the supply chain, you know, it's everything from the drug, you know, the drug suppliers to the company that supplies the oxygen tanks, that supplying their, I mean, in this day and age, right, that supplying their PPE. So I think it's really just exposing how broad and how complex this environment really is.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. Just in my own experience, working with health systems from small to large, we occasionally run into that. Well, I'm still using a database that runs on DOS, and we're not getting rid of it. And it's like, well, it's kind of paying lip service to the whole HIPAA compliant thing, at least here in the United States, let alone other compliances around the world that other governments have. But I think it actually opens up another question when we're thinking about this, because I remember right at the beginning of this pandemic, when everybody was getting locked down and the whole world was kind of, just scrambling to secure themselves. We had seen statements from groups like the Maze ransomware gang and all of that saying, well, we're not going to hit hospitals and health systems. And it really doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. And I was just wondering if the CTA is seeing the same thing. No honor among thieves, if you will.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, we have joked among ourselves, look at that. It turns out they're untrustworthy criminals. I mean, we have not seen that. I think most of the, again, we some of it does appear to just sort of be part of the random, sort of spraying of, attacks that happen, but we certainly have not seen anybody take steps to not target the healthcare sector.
Yeah. I mean, my Sunday videos are always breaches of the week, and last Sunday was actually Parkview Medical System in Pueblo County, Colorado, getting hit. So I think it's a nonstop thing. But I think that's also why groups like the Cyber Threat Alliance exist, because that is such an integral part of just getting this, catching these guys in the wild and then sharing it with all of the other types of detection technologies. So if I'm running one platform and you're running another, now they're updating and inoculating in real time, which is, I think, just the beauty of the collaboration that you guys have going in the CTA. And that's also, I think, a little bit of what we're doing here in the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition here, as we've had wonderful partnership with you thus far. So with that, is there anything else that you'd you'd like to share? And thank you for joining me here. This has been just awesome. Thank you.
Oh, very happy to do it. And the other thing I would say is, we are always very open to, CTA is focused on cybersecurity providers. So those that provide cybersecurity services to others, whether you are a cybersecurity vendor, to use that term, or a platform provider. So always, you can always check out our website and see how to get in touch with us. And, if you want to, if you're interested in exploring what being a CTA member would mean.
Yes,
but great. I will also just say too, that we very much appreciate, the volunteers and the folks that are working so hard to help protect the infrastructure. So we very much thanks to you and the organization for the work that you're doing to help, combat all the different phishing and scams and other things that are going on during this pandemic.
Yes, and thank you for everything that the Alliance is doing. I can tell you personally, there's a lot of products that are members that I use, for my customers, and I feel a lot. I sleep better at night knowing that your organization exists and you guys are just doing wonderful work. And of course, if people want to get in touch with you or follow you or the Cyber Threat Alliance, where can they find you? Or the Cyber Threat Alliance.
So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Cy Alliance Prez. You could also find the Cyber Alliance, Cyber Threat Alliance on Twitter as well. I'm also on LinkedIn, so you can find me there. Then of course our website is, cyberthreatalliance.org.
Great. And again, Michael, thank you so much. It's been an honor just talking everything from White House cybersecurity to COVID-19 to the Cyber Threat Alliance. And thank you again for your time.
Thanks. You're quite welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show with Nick Espinoza. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Ruddenberg. Her email is ursula@pacifica.org. Again, that's ursula@pacifica.org. Again, I'm Nick Espinoza here in Chicago. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español en respuesta